Me? A tear overbrimmed her left eye and slipped down her cheek. She wasn't all cried out after all, it seemed. She thought what she said would perhaps shame him, but although faint color came into his cheeks, his eyes remained firmly on hers. "I fell in love with you," he said. "That's why I said it. It happened even before you kissed me, I think." She laughed at that, but the simplicity with which he had spoken made her laughter sound false in her own ears. Tinny. "Mr. Dearborn, Will, please." "Mr. Dearborn," she said, patiently as a teacher working with a dull student, "the idea is ridiculous. On the basis of one single meeting, one single kiss, a sister's kiss?" Now she was the one who was blushing, but she hurried on. "Such things happen in stories, but in real life, I think not." But his eyes never left hers, and in them she saw some of Roland's truth, the deep romance of his nature buried like a fabulous streak of alien metal in the granite of his practicality. He accepted love as a fact rather than a flower, and it rendered her genial contempt powerless over both of them. "I cry your pardon," he repeated. There was a kind of brute stubbornness in him. It exasperated her, amused her, and appalled her all at the same time. "I don't ask you to return my love. That's not why I spoke. You told me your affairs were complicated." Now his eyes did leave hers, and he looked off toward the drop. He even laughed a little. "I called him a bit of a fool, didn't I? To your face. So who's the fool after all?" She smiled, couldn't help it. "He also said ye'd heard he was fond of strong drink and berry girls." Roland hit his forehead with the heel of his hand. If his friend Arthur Heath had done that, she would have taken it as a deliberate comic gesture. Not with Will. She had an idea he wasn't much for comedy. Silence between them again, this time not so uncomfortable. The two horses, Rusher and Pylon, cropping contentedly side by side. "If we were horses, all this would be much easier," she thought, and almost giggled. "Mr. Dearborn, ye understand that I have agreed to an arrangement?"
"Aye," he smiled when she raised her eyebrows in surprise. "It's not mockery, but the dialect. It just seeps in."
"Who told ye of my business?"
"The mayor's sister."
"Coral."
She wrinkled her nose and decided she wasn't surprised. And she supposed there were others who could have explained her situation even more crudely. Eldred Jonas for one, Rhea of the Coos for another. Best to leave it.
"So if you understand, and if you don't ask me to return your... whatever it is you think you feel, why are we talking? Why do you seek me out? I think it makes you passing uncomfortable..."
"Yes," he said. And then, as if stating a simple fact, "it makes me uncomfortable, all right. I can barely look at you and keep my head."
"Then mayhap it'd be best not to look, not to speak, not to think."
Her voice was both sharp and a little shaky. How could he have the courage to say such things, to just state them straight out and starry-eyed like that?
"Why did you send me the bouquet and that note? Are you not aware of the trouble you could have gotten me into if you knew my aunt? She's already spoken to me about you, and if she knew about the note or saw us together out here..."
She looked around, verifying that they were still unobserved. They were, at least as best she could tell. He reached out, touched her shoulder. She looked at him, and he pulled his fingers back as if he had put them on something hot. "I said what I did so you'd understand," he said. "That's all. I feel how I feel, and you're not responsible for that."
"But I am," she thought. "I kissed you. I think I'm more than a little responsible for how we both feel, Will."
"What I said while we were dancing, I regret with all my heart. Won't you give me your pardon?"
"I," she said,
and if he had taken her in his arms at that moment she would have let him, and damned the consequences. But he only took off his hat and made her a charming little bow, and the wind died. "Thank you, Si.
Don't call me that. I hate it. My name is Susan."
"Will you call me Will?" She nodded. "Good. Susan, I want to ask you something. Not as the fellow who insulted you and hurt you because he was jealous. This is something else entirely. May I?"
I suppose,"
she said warily. "Are you for the affiliation?" She looked at him, flabbergasted. It was the last question in the world she had expected, but he was looking at her seriously.
"I'd expected ye and your friends to count cows and guns and spears and boats and who knows what else," she said. "But I didn't think thee would also count affiliation supporters."
She saw his look of surprise, and a little smile at the corners of his mouth. This time the smile made him look older than he could possibly be. Susan thought back across what she'd just said, realized what must have struck him, and gave a small, embarrassed laugh.
"My aunt has a way of lapsing into thee and thou. My father did, too. It's from a sect of the old people who called themselves friends."
"I know. We have the friendly folk in my part of the world still."
"Do you?"
"Yes. Or I, if you like the sound of that better. I'm coming, too. And I like the way the friends talk. It has a lovely sound."
"Not when my aunt uses it,"
Susan said, thinking back to the argument over the shirt.
"To answer your question, I'm for the affiliation, I suppose. Because my dad was. If you ask, am I strong for the affiliation, I suppose not. We see and hear little enough of them these days. Mostly rumors and stories carried by drifters and far-traveling drummers. Now that there's no railway..."
She shrugged. "Most of the ordinary day-to-day folk I've spoken to seem to feel the same. And yet your Mayor Thorin..."
"He's not my Mayor Thorin,"
she said, more sharply than she had intended. "And yet the barony's Mayor Thorin has given us every help we've asked for, and some we haven't. I have only to snap my fingers, and Kimber Rymer stands before me."
"Then don't snap them,"
she said, looking around in spite of herself. She tried to smile and show it was a joke, but didn't make much success of it. "The townsfolk, the fisher folk, the farmers, the cowboys, they all speak well of the affiliation, but distantly. Yet the mayor, his chancellor, and the members of the Horsemen's Association, Lengel and Garber and that lot..."
"I know them,"
she said shortly. "They're absolutely enthusiastic in their support. Mention the affiliation to Sheriff Avery, and he all but dances. In every ranch parlor we're offered a drink from an eld commemorative cup, it seems."
"A drink of what?"
she asked a trifle roguishly.
"Beer? Ale? Graff?"
"Also wine, whiskey, and pettibone," he said, not responding to her smile. "It's almost as if they wish us to break our vow. Does that strike you as strange?"
"Aye, a little. Or just as Hambry hospitality. In these parts, when someone, especially a young man, says he's taken the pledge, folks tend to think him coy, not serious."
"And this joyful support of the affiliation amongst the movers and the shakers, how does that strike you?"
"Queer."
And it did. Pat Delgado's work had brought him in almost daily contact with these landowners and horse breeders, and so she, who had tagged after her dad any time he would let her, had seen plenty of them. She thought them a cold bunch, by and large. She couldn't imagine John Croydon or Jake White waving an Arthur Eld Stein in a sentimental toast, especially not in the middle of the day, when there was stock to be run and sold. Will's eyes were full upon her as if he were reading these thoughts. "But you probably don't see as much of the big fellows as you once did," he said, "before your father passed, I mean."
"Perhaps not. But do bumblers learn to speak backward?"
No cautious smile this time. This time he outright grinned. It lit his whole face. Gods, how handsome he was! "I suppose not. No more than cats can change their spots, as we say. And Mayor Thorin doesn't speak of such as us, me and my friends, to you when you two are alone? Or is that question beyond what I have a right to ask? I suppose it is.
I care not about that, she said, tossing her head pertly enough to make her long braids swing. I understand little of propriety, as some have been good enough to point out.
But she didn't care as much for his downcast look and flush of embarrassment as she had expected. She knew girls who liked to tease as well as flirt, and to tease hard, some of them, but it seemed she had no taste for it. Certainly she had no desire to set her claws in him. And when she went on, she spoke gently.
I'm not alone with him in any case. And oh, how ye do lie, she thought mournfully, remembering how Thorin had embraced her in the hall on the night of the party, groping at her breasts like a child trying to get his hand into a candy jar, telling her that he burned for her. Oh, ye great liar. In any case, Will, Hart's opinion of you and your friends can hardly concern ye, can it? Ye have a job to do, that's all. If he helps you, why not just accept and be grateful?
Because something's wrong here, he said, and the serious, almost somber quality of his voice frightened her a little.
Wrong? With the mayor? With the Horsemen's Association? What are you talking about?
He looked at her steadily, then seemed to decide something. I'm going to trust you, Susan.
I'm not sure I want thy trust any more than I want thy love, she said.
He nodded. And yet to do the job I was sent to do, I have to trust someone. Can you understand that? She looked into his eyes, then nodded. He stepped next to her, so close she fancied she could feel the warmth of his skin. Look down there. Tell me what you see. She looked, then shrugged.
The drop, same as always.
She smiled a little.
And as beautiful. This has always been my favorite place in all the world.
Aye, it's beautiful, all right. What else do you see?
Horses, of courses.
She smiled to show this was a joke, an old one of her dad's, in fact. But he didn't smile back. Fair to look at, and courageous, if the stories they were already telling about town were true, quick in both thought and movement, too. Really not much sense of humor, though. Well, there were worse failings. Grabbing a girl's bosom when she wasn't expecting it might be one of them. Horses, yes. But does it look like the right number of them? You've been seeing horses on the drop all your life, and surely no one who's not in the Horsemen's Association is better qualified to say.
And ye don't trust them?
They've given us everything we've asked for, and they're as friendly as dogs under the dinner table. But no, I don't think I do.
Yet ye'd trust me.
He looked at her steadily with his beautiful and frightening eyes, a darker blue than they would later be, not yet faded out by the suns of 10,000 drifting days. I have to trust someone, he repeated. She looked down, almost as though he had rebuked her. He reached out, put gentle fingers beneath her chin, and tipped her face up again. Does it seem the right number? Think carefully. But now that he'd brought it to her attention, she hardly needed to think about it at all. She had been aware of the change for some time, she supposed, but it had been gradual, easy to overlook.
No, she said at last. It's not right.
Too few or too many? Which? She paused for a moment, drew in breath, let it out in a long sigh.
Too many. Far too many.
Will Dearborn raised his clenched fists to shoulder height and gave them a single hard shake. His blue eyes blazed like the sparklights of which her granddad had told her.
I knew it, he said. I knew it.
8. How many horses are down there? He asked.
Below us, or on the hull drop?
Just below us. She looked carefully, making no attempt to actually count, That didn't work. It only confused you. She saw four good-sized groups of about 20 horses each, moving about on the green almost exactly as birds moved about in the blue above them. There were perhaps 9 smaller groups, ranging from octets to quartets, several pairs, they reminded her of lovers, but everything did today, it seemed, a few galloping loners, young stallions, mostly. 160? He asked in a low, almost hesitant voice. She looked at him, surprised.
Aye, 160's the number I had in mind, to a pin.
And how much of the drop are we looking at? A quarter? A third?
Much less. She tilted him a small smile, as I think thee knows. 1/6 of the total open graze, perhaps.
If there are 160 horses free grazing on each 1/6, that comes to... She waited for him to come up with 960. When he did, she nodded. He looked down a moment longer and grunted with surprise when Rusher nosed him in the small of the back. Susan put a curled hand to her mouth to stifle a laugh. From the impatient way he pushed the horse's muzzle away, she guessed he still saw little that was funny. "How many more are stabled or training or working, do you reckon?" he asked.
"One for every 3 down there, at a guess.
So we'd be talking 1,200 head of horses, all threaded stock, no muties." She looked at him with faint surprise.
"Aye, there's almost no muty stock here in Magus, in any of the outer baronies, for that matter."
"You true breed more than 3 out of every 5?"
"We breed 'em all. Of course, every now and then we get a freak that has to be put down, but not one freak out of every 5 live births.
1 out of 5 born with, how would Renfrew put it, with extra legs or its guts on the outside?" Her shocked look was enough answer.
"Who's been telling ye such?"
"Renfrew. He also told me that there was about 570 head of threaded stock here in Magus."
"That's just..."
She gave a bewildered little laugh.
"Just crazy. If my dad was here..."
"But he's not," Roland said, his tone as dry as a snapping twig. "He's dead." For a moment she seemed not to register the change in that tone. Then, as if an eclipse had begun to happen somewhere inside her head, her entire aspect darkened.
"My dad had an accident. Do you understand that, Will Dearborn? An accident. It was terribly sad, but the sort of thing that happens sometimes. A horse rolled on him. Ocean foam. Fran says foam saw a snake in the grass."
"Fran Lengill?"
"Aye."
Her skin was pale, except for 2 wild roses, pink like those in the bouquet he'd sent her by way of Shimi, glowing high up on her cheekbones.
"Fran rode many miles with my father. They weren't great friends, they were of different classes, for one thing, but they rode together. I've a cap put away somewhere that Fran's first wife made for my christening. They rode the trail together. I can't believe Fran Lengel would lie about how my dad died, let alone that he had anything to do with it."
Yet she looked doubtfully down at the running horses. So many, too many. Her dad would have seen. And her dad would have wondered what she was wondering now, whose brands were on the extras. "It so happens Fran Lengel and my friend Stockworth had a discussion about horses," Will said. His voice sounded almost casual, but there was nothing casual on his face. "Over glasses of spring water after beer had been offered and refused. They spoke of them much as I did with Renfrew at Mayor Thorin's welcoming dinner. When Richard asked Cy Lengel to estimate riding horses, he said perhaps 400.
"Insane."
"It would seem so," Will agreed.
"Do they not ken it? The horses are out here where you can see 'em?"
"They know we've barely gotten started," he said, "and that we've begun with the fisher folk. We'll be a month yet, I'm sure they think, before we start to concern ourselves with the horse flesh hereabouts. And in the meantime, they have an attitude about us of... how shall I put it? Well, never mind how I'd put it. I'm not very good with words. But my friend Arthur calls it genial contempt. They leave the horses out in front of our eyes, I think, because they don't believe we'll know what we're looking at, or because they think we won't believe what we're seeing. I'm very glad I found you out here. Just so I could give you a more accurate horse count, is that the only reason?
But you will get around to counting the horses. Eventually, I mean, that must surely be one of the affiliation's main needs.
He gave her an odd look, as if she had missed something that should have been obvious. It made her feel self-conscious.
What? What is it?
Perhaps they expect the extra horses to be gone by the time we get around to this side of the barony's business.
Gone where?
I don't know. But I don't like this. Susan, you will keep this just between the two of us, won't you? She nodded. She'd be insane to tell anyone she'd been with Will Dearborn, unchaperoned except by Rusher and Pylon, out on the drop. It may all turn out to be nothing. But if it doesn't, knowing could be dangerous. Which led back to her dad again. Langle had told her and Aunt Cord that Pat had been thrown, and that ocean foam had then rolled upon him. Neither of them had had any reason to doubt the man's story. But Fran Langle had also told Will's friend that there were only 400 head of riding stock in Magus, and that was a bald lie. Will turned to his horse, and she was glad. Part of her wanted him to stay, to stand close to her while the clouds sent their long shadows flying across the grassland. But they had been together out here too long already. There was no reason to think anyone would come along and see them. But instead of comforting her, that idea for some reason made her more nervous than ever. He straightened the stirrup hanging beside the scabbarded shaft of his lance. Rusher whickered way back in his throat as if to say, about time we got going. Then turned to her again. She actually felt faint as his gaze fell upon her, and now the idea of Kaa was almost too strong to deny. She tried to tell herself it was just the dim, that feeling of having lived a thing before. But it wasn't the dim. It was a sense of finding a road one had been searching for all along. There's something else I want to say. I don't like returning to where we started, but I must.
No, she said faintly. That's closed, surely.
I told you that I loved you, and that I was jealous, he said. And for the first time his voice had come unanchored a little, wavering in his throat. She was alarmed to see that there were tears standing in his eyes. There was more. Something more.
Will, I don't want to...
She turned blindly for her horse. He took her shoulder and turned her back. It wasn't a harsh touch, but there was an inexorability to it that was dreadful. She looked helplessly up into his face, saw that he was young and far from home, and suddenly understood she could not stand against him for long. She wanted him so badly that she ached with it. She would have given a year of her life just to be able to put her palms on his cheeks and feel his skin. "You miss your father, Susan."
"Aye," she whispered, "with all my heart I do."
"I miss my mother the same way." He held her by both shoulders now, one eye overbrimmed. One tear drew a silver line down his cheek.
"Is she dead?"
"No, but something happened. About her. To her. Shit. How can I talk about it when I don't even know how to think about it? In a way, she did die. For me."
"Well, that's terrible."
He nodded. "The last time I saw her, she looked at me in a way that will haunt me to my grave. Shame and love and hope, all of them bound up together. Shame at what I'd seen and knew about her. Hope, maybe, that I'd understand and forgive." He took a deep breath. The night of the party, toward the end of the meal, Reimer said something funny. "You all laughed."
"If I did, it was only because it would have looked strange if I was the only one who didn't," Susan said. "I don't like him. I think he's a schemer and a conniver."
"You all laughed, and I happened to look down toward the end of the table, toward Olive Thorin. And for a moment, only a moment, I thought she was my mother. The expression was the same, you see, the same one I saw on the morning when I opened the wrong door at the wrong time and came upon my mother and her..." "Stop it!" she cried, pulling back from his hands. Inside her, everything was suddenly in motion. All the mooring lines and buckles and clamps she'd been using to hold herself together seeming to melt at once.
"Stop it! Just stop it! I can't listen to you talk about her!"
She groped out for Pylon, but now the whole world was wet prisms. She began to sob. She felt his hands on her shoulders, turning her again, and she did not resist them.
"I'm so ashamed," she said. "I'm so ashamed and so frightened, and I'm sorry. I've forgotten my father's face. And
I'll never be able to find it again," she wanted to say, but she didn't have to say anything. He stopped her mouth with his kisses. At first she just let herself be kissed, and then she was kissing him back, kissing him almost furiously. She wiped the wetness from beneath his eyes with soft little sweeps of her thumbs, then slipped her palms up his cheeks as she had longed to do. The feeling was exquisite. Even the soft rasp of the stubble close to the skin was exquisite. She slid her arms around his neck, her open mouth on his, holding him and kissing him as hard as she could, kissing him there between the horses, who simply looked at each other and then went back to cropping grass. Nine. They were the best kisses of his whole life, and never forgotten. The yielding pliancy of her lips and the strong shape of her teeth under them, urgent and not shy in the least, the fragrance of her breath, the sweet line of her body pressed against his. He slipped a hand up to her left breast, squeezed it gently, and felt her heart speeding under it. His other hand went to her hair and combed along the side of it, silk at her temple. He never forgot its texture. Then she was standing away from him, her face flaming with blush and passion, one hand going to her lips, which he had kissed until they were swollen. A little trickle of blood ran from the corner of the lower one, her eyes wide on his, her bosom rising and falling as if she had just run a race. And between them a current that was like nothing he had ever felt in his life. It ran like a river and shook like a fever.
"No more," she said in a trembling voice. "No more, please. If you really do love me, don't let me dishonor myself. I've made a promise. Anything might come later after that promise was fulfilled, I suppose, if you still wanted me."
"I would wait forever," he said calmly, "and do anything for you, but stand away and watch you go with another man."
"Then, if you love me, go away from me. Please, Will."
Another kiss. She stepped forward at once, raising her face trustingly up to his, and he understood he could do whatever he wanted with her. She was, at least for the moment, no longer her own mistress. She might, consequently, be his. He could do to her what Martin had done to his own mother, if that was his fancy. The thought broke his passion apart, turned it to coals that fell in a bright shower, winking out one by one in a dark bewilderment. His father's acceptance, I have known for 2 years, was in many ways the worst part of what had happened to him this year. How could he fall in love with this girl, any girl, in a world where such evils of the heart seemed necessary and might even be repeated? Yet he did love her. Instead of the passionate kiss he wanted, he placed his lips lightly on the corner of her mouth where the little rill of blood flowed. He kissed, tasting salt like the taste of his own tears. He closed his eyes and shivered when her hand stroked the hair at the nape of his neck.
"I'd not hurt Olive Thorin for the world," she whispered in his ear. "No more than I'd hurt thee, Will. I didn't understand. And now 'tis too late to be put right. But thank you for not taking what you could. And I'll remember you always, how it was to be kissed by you. It's the best thing that ever happened to me, I think. Like heaven and earth all wrapped up together.
I'll remember, too." He watched her swing up into the saddle and remembered how her bare legs had flashed in the dark on the night he had met her. and suddenly he couldn't let her go. He reached forward, touched her boot. "Susan."
"No," she said, "please."
He stood back. Somehow.
"This is our secret," she said. "Yes?"
"Aye." She smiled at that, but it was a sad smile.
"Stay away from me from now on, Will, please, and I'll stay away from you."
He thought about it. "If we can."
"We must, Will, we must."
She rode away, fast. Roland stood beside Rusher's stirrup, watching her go. And when she was out of sight, over the horizon, still he watched. Ten. Sheriff Avery, Deputy Dave, and Deputy George Riggins were sitting on the porch in front of the sheriff's office and jail when Mr. Stockworth and Mr. Heath, the latter with that idiotic bird skull still mounted on the horn of his saddle, went past at a steady walk. The bell of noon had rung 15 minutes before, and Sheriff Avery reckoned they were on their way to lunch, perhaps at the mill bank, or perhaps at the rest, which put on a fair noon meal, popkins and such. Avery liked something a little more filling. Half a chicken or a haunch of beef suited him just fine. Mr. Heath gave them a wave and a grin. "Good day, gents. Long life, gentle breezes, happy siestas." They waved and smiled back. When they were out of sight, Dave said, "They spent all morning down there on the piers counting nets." "Nets? Do you believe it?" "Yes, sir," Sheriff Avery said, lifting one massive cheek a bit out of his rocker and letting off a noisy pre-luncheon fart. "Yes, sir, I do, I." George said, "If not for them facing off Jones's boys the way they done, I'd think they was a pack of fools." "Nor would they likely mind," Avery said. He looked at Dave, who was twirling his monocle on the end of its ribbon and looking off in the direction the boys had taken. There were folks in town who had begun calling the affiliation brats little coffin hunters. Avery wasn't sure what to make of that. He'd soothed it down between them and Thorin's hard boys, and had gotten both a commendation and a piece of gold from Reimer for his efforts. But still, what to make of them? "The day they came in," he said to Dave, "he thought they were soft. How do ye say now?" "Now?" Dave twirled his monocle a final time, then popped it in his eye and stared at the sheriff through it. "Now I think they might have been a little harder than I thought, after all." "Yes, indeed," Avery thought. "But hard don't mean smart, thank the gods. I thank the gods for that." "I'm hungry as a bull, so I am," he said, getting up. He bent, put his hands on his knees, and ripped off another loud fart. Dave and George looked at each other. George fanned a hand in front of his face. Sheriff Herkimer Avery, Barony Sheriff, straightened up, looking both relieved and anticipatory. "More room out than there is in," he said. "Come on, boys, let's go down street and tuck into a little." 11. Not even sunset could do much to improve the view from the porch of the Bar K bunkhouse. The building, except for the cook shack and the stable, the only one still standing on what had been the homemaker, was L-shaped, and the porch was built on the inside of the short arm. Left for them on it had been just the right number of seats, two splintery rockers and a wooden crate to which an unstable board back had been nailed. On this evening, Alain sat in one of the rockers, and Cuthbert sat on the box seat, which he seemed to fancy. On the rail, peering across the beaten dirt of the dooryard and toward the burned-out hulk of the Garber home place, was the lookout. Alain was bone-tired, and although both of them had bathed in the stream near the west end of the homemaker, he thought he still smelled fish and seaweed on himself. They had spent the day counting nets. He was not averse to hard work, even when it was monotonous, but he didn't like pointless work, which this was. Hambry came in two parts, the fishers and the horse breeders. There was nothing for them among the fishers, and after 3 weeks all three of them knew it. Their answers were out on the drop, at which they had so far done no more than look, at Roland's order. The wind gusted, and for a moment they could hear the low, grumbling, squealing sound of the thinny.
"I hate that sound," Alan said. Cuthbert, unusually silent and introspective tonight, nodded and said only, "Aye." They were all saying that now, not to mention so you do, and so I am, and so it is.
Alan suspected the three of them would have Hambry on their tongues long after they had wiped its dust from their boots. From behind them, inside the bunkhouse door, came a less unpleasant sound, the cooing of pigeons. And then, from around the side of the bunkhouse, a third, for which he and Cuthbert had unconsciously been listening as they sat watching the sun go down. Horses' hoofs. Rushers. Roland came around the corner, riding easy, and as he did, something happened that struck Alain as oddly portentous, a kind of omen. There was a flurry flutter of wings, a dark shape in the air, and suddenly a bird was roosting on Roland's shoulder. He didn't jump, barely looked around. He rode up to the hitching rail and sat there, holding out his hand. "Heil," he said softly, and the pigeon stepped into his palm. Bound to one of its legs was a capsule. Roland removed it, opened it, and took out a tiny strip of paper, which had been rolled tight. In his other hand he held the pigeon out. "Heil," Alan said, holding out his own hand. The pigeon flew to it. As Roland dismounted, Alan took the pigeon into the bunkhouse, where the cages had been placed beneath an open window. He ungated the center one and held out his hand. The pigeon which had just arrived hopped in. The pigeon in the cage hopped out and into his palm. Alan shut the cage door, latched it, crossed the room, and turned up the pillow of Bert's bunk. Beneath it was a linen envelope containing a number of blank paper strips and a tiny storage pen. He took one of the strips and the pen, which held its own small reservoir of ink and did not have to be dipped. He went back out on the porch. Roland and Cuthbert were studying the unrolled strip of paper the pigeon had delivered from Gilead. On it was a line of tiny geometric shapes. "What does it say?" Alan asked. The code was simple enough, but he could not get it by heart or read it on sight, as Roland and Bert had been able to almost immediately. Alain's talents, his ability to track, his easy access to the touch, lay in other directions. "Farson moves east," Cuthbert read. "Forces split, one big, one small. Do you see anything unusual?" He looked at Roland, almost offended. "Anything unusual? What does that mean?" Roland shook his head. He didn't know. He doubted if the men who had sent the message, of whom his own father was almost surely one, did either. Alain handed Cuthbert the strip and the pen. With one finger, Bert stroked the head of the softly cooing pigeon. It ruffled its wings as if already anxious to be off to the west. "What shall I write?" Cuthbert asked. "The same?" Roland nodded. "But we have seen things that are unusual," Alain said. "And we know things are wrong here. The horses, and at that small ranch way south. I can't remember the name." Cuthbert could. "The Rocking H." "Aye, the Rocking H. There are oxen there. Oxen! My gods, I've never seen them except for pictures in a book." Roland looked alarmed. "Does anyone know you saw?" Alain shrugged impatiently. "I don't think so. There were drovers about, three, maybe four." "Four, aye," Cuthbert said quietly. "But they paid no attention to us. Even when we see things, they think we don't. And that's the way it must stay." Roland's eyes swept them, but there was a kind of absence in his face, as if his thoughts were far away. He turned to look toward the sunset, and Alain saw something on the collar of his shirt. He plucked it, a move made so quickly and nimbly that not even Roland felt it. Bert couldn't have done that, Alain thought with some pride. "Aye, but same message," Roland said. He sat down on the top step and looked off toward the evening redness in the west. "Patience, Mr. Richard Stockworth and Mr. Arthur Heath. We know certain things, and we believe certain other things, But would John Farson come all this way simply to resupply horses? I don't think so. I'm not sure. Horses are valuable. Aye, so they are. But I'm not sure. So we wait. All right. All right, same message. Cuthbert smoothed the scrap of paper flat on the porch rail, then made a small series of symbols on it. Alain could read this message. He had seen the same sequence several times since they had come to Hambry. Message received. We are fine. Nothing to report at this time. The message was put in the capsule and attached to the pigeon's leg. Alain went down the steps, stood beside Rusher, still waiting patiently to be unsaddled, and held the bird up toward the fading sunset. Heil! It was up and gone in a flutter of wings. For a moment only they saw it, a dark shape against the deepening sky. Roland sat, looking after. The dreamy expression was still on his face. Alain found himself wondering if Roland had made the right decision this evening. He had never in his life had such a thought, nor expected to have one. Roland? Hm? Like a man half-awakened from some deep sleep. I'll unsaddle him if you want, he nodded at Rusher, and rub him down. No answer, for a long time. Alain was about to ask again when Roland said, No, I'll do it, in a minute or two, and went back to looking at the sunset. Alain climbed the porch steps and sat down in his rocker. Bert had resumed his place on the box seat. They were behind Roland now, and Cuthbert looked at Alain with his eyebrows raised. He pointed to Roland, and then looked at Alain again. Alain passed over what he had plucked from Roland's collar. Although it was almost too fine to be seen in this light, Cuthbert's eyes were gunslinger's eyes, and he took it easily, with no fumbling. It was a long strand of hair, the color of spun gold. He could see from Bert's face that Bert knew whose head it had come from. Since arriving in Hambry, they'd met only one girl with long blonde hair. The two boys' eyes met. In Bert's, Alain saw dismay and laughter in equal measure. Cuthbert Allgood raised his forefinger to his temple and mimed pulling the trigger. Alain nodded. Sitting on the steps with his back to them, Roland looked toward the dying sunset with dreaming eyes. Chapter 8 Beneath the Peddler's Moon 1 The town of Ritzy, nearly 400 miles west of Mages, was anything but. Roy DePape reached it 3 nights before the Peddler's Moon, called Late Summer's Moon by some, came full, and left it a day later. Ritzy was, in fact, a miserable little mining village on the eastern slope of the Vicastus Mountains, about 50 miles from Vicastus Cut. The town had but one street. It was engraved with iron-hard wheel ruts now, and would become a lake of mud roughly 3 days after the storms of autumn set in. There was the Bear and Turtle, mercantile and sundry items, where miners were forbidden by the Vicastus Company to shop, and a company store where no one but grubbies would shop. There was a combined jailhouse and town gathering hall, with a windmill cum gallows out front. There were 6 roaring bar rooms, each more sordid, desperate, and dangerous than the last. Ritzy was like an ugly lowered head between a pair of huge, shrugged shoulders— the foothills. Above town, to the south, were the clapped-out shacks where the company housed its miners. Each puff of breeze brought the stench of their unlimed communal privies. To the north were the mines themselves, dangerous, undershored scratch drifts that went down 50 feet or so, and then spread like fingers clutching for gold and silver and copper and the occasional nest of fire dims. From the outside, they were just holes punched into the bare and rocky earth, holes like staring eyes, each with its own pile of till and scrapings beside the adit. Once there had been freehold mines up there, but they were all gone, regulated out by the Vicastus Company. DePape knew all about it, because the big coffin hunters had been a part of that little spin and rarity. just after he'd hooked up with Jonas and Reynolds, that had been. Why, they had gotten those coffins tattooed on their hands not 50 miles from here, in the town of Wind, a mud pen even less ritzy than ritzy. How long ago? He couldn't rightly say, although it seemed to him that he should be able to. But when it came to reckoning times past, DePape often felt lost. It was hard even to remember how old he was, because the world had moved on, and time was different now. Softer. One thing he had no trouble remembering at all. His recollection was refreshed by the miserable flare of pain he suffered each time he bumped his wounded finger. That one thing was a promise to himself that he would see Dearborn, Stockworth, and Heath laid out dead in a row, hand to outstretched hand, like a little girl's paper dolls. He intended to unlimber the part of him which had longed so bootlessly for her nibs these last 3 weeks and use it to hose down their dead faces. The majority of his squirt would be saved for Arthur Heath of Gilead, New Canaan. That laughing chatterbox motherfucker had a serious hosing down coming. DePape rode out the sunrise end of Ritzy's only street, trotted his horse up the flank of the first hill, and paused at the top for a single look back. Last night, when he'd been talking to the old bastard behind Hadigan's, Ritzy had been roaring. This morning, at 7, it looked as ghostly as the peddler's moon, which still hung in the sky above the rim of the plundered hills. He could hear the mines tink-tonking away, though. You bet. Those babies tink-tonked away 7 days a week. No rest for the wicked. And he supposed that included him. He dragged his horse's head around with his usual unthinking and ham-handed force, booted its flanks, and headed east, thinking of the old bastard as he went. He had treated the old bastard passing fair, he reckoned. A reward had been promised and had been paid for information given. "Yar," DePape said, his glasses flashing in the new sun. It was a rare morning when he had no hangover, and he felt quite cheerful. "I reckon the old bugger can't complain." DePape had had no trouble following the young cull's back trail. They had come east on the Great Road the whole way from New Canaan, it appeared, and at every town where they had stopped, they had been marked. In most, they were marked if they did no more than pass through. And why not? Young men on good horses, no scars on their faces, no regulator tattoos on their hands, good clothes on their backs, expensive hats on their heads. They were remembered especially well at the inns and saloons where they had stopped to refresh themselves but had drunk no hard liquor, no beer or graff either, for that matter. Yes, they were remembered. Boys on the road, boys that seemed almost to shine, as if they had come from an earlier, better time. "Piss in their faces," DePape thought as he rode. "One by one. Mr. Arthur Ha-Ha Heath last. I'll save enough so it'd drown you were you not already at the end of the path and into the clearing." They had been noticed, all right. But that wasn't good enough. If he went back to Hambury with no more than that, Jonas would likely shoot his nose off. And he would deserve it. They may be rich boys, but that's not all they are. DePape had said that himself. The question was, what else were they? And finally, in the shit and sulfur stench of Ritzy, he had found out. Not everything, perhaps, but enough to allow him to turn his horse around before he found himself all the way back in fucking New Canaan. He had hit two other saloons, sipping watered beer in each, before rolling into Hadigan's. He ordered yet another watered beer and prepared to engage the bartender in conversation. Before he even began to shake the tree, however, the apple he wanted fell off and dropped into his hand, neat as you please. It was an old man's voice, an old bastard's voice, speaking with the shrill, head-hurting intensity which is the sole province of old bastards in their cups. He was talking about the old days, as old bastards always did, and about how the world had moved on and how things had been ever so much better when he was a boy. Then he had said something which caused DePape's ears to prick up. Something about how the old days might be coming again, for hadn't he seen three young lords not 2 months agone, mayhap less, and even bought one of them a drink, even if 'twas only sarsaparilla soda? "You wouldn't know a young lord from a young turd," said a miss who appeared to have all of 4 teeth left in her charming young head. There was general laughter at this. The old bastard looked around, offended.
"I know, all right," he said. "I forgot more than you'll ever learn, so I have. One of 'em at least came from the outline, for I saw his father in his face. Just as clear as I see your saggy tits, Jolene."
And then the old bastard had done something DePape rather admired, yanked out the front of the saloon whore's blouse and poured the remainder of his beer down it. Even the roars of laughter and heavy applause which greeted this couldn't entirely drown the girl's caw of rage or the old man's cries when she began to slap and punch him about the head and shoulders. These latter cries were only indignant at first, but when the girl grabbed the old bastard's own beer stein and shattered it against the side of his head, they became screams of pain. Blood, mixed with a few watery dregs of beer, began to run down the old bastard's face.
"Get out of here!"
she yelled and gave him a shove toward the door. Several healthy kicks from the miners in attendance, who had changed sides as easily as the wind changes directions, helped him along.
"And don't come back. I can smell the weed on your breath, you old cocksucker. Get out and take your God's cuss stories of old days and young lords with you."
The old bastard was in such manner conveyed across the room, past the tootling trumpet player who served as entertainment for the patrons of Hadigan's. That young bowler-hatted worthy added his own kick in the seat of the old bastard's dusty trousers without ever missing so much as a single note of Play Lady's Play, and out through the batwing doors, where he collapsed face first into the street. DePape had sauntered after him and helped him up. As he did so, he smelled an acrid odor, not beer, on the old man's breath, and saw the telltale greenish-gray discolorations at the corners of his lips. Weed, all right. The old bastard was probably just getting started on it, and for the usual reason, devil grass was free in the hills, unlike the beer and whiskey that was sold in town. But once they started, the finish came quick.
"They got no respect," the old bastard said thickly. "Nor understanding, either."
"Aye, so they don't," said DePape,
who had not yet gotten the accents of the seacoast and the drop out of his speech. The old bastard stood, swaying, looking up at him, wiping ineffectually at the blood which ran down his wrinkled cheeks from his lacerated scalp.
"Son, do you have the price of a drink? Remember the face of your father, and give an old soul the price of a drink."
"I'm not much for charity, old-timer," DePape said. "But mayhap you could earn yourself the price of a drink. Step on over here into my office, and let's us see."
He'd led the old bastard out of the street and back to the boardwalk, angling well to the left of the black bat wings with their golden shafts of light spilling out above and below. He waited for a trio of miners to go by, singing at the top of their lungs, "Woman I love is long and tall, she moves her body like a cannonball," and then, still holding the old bastard by the elbow, had guided him into the alley between Hadigan's and the undertaking establishment next door. For some people, DePape mused, a visit to Ritzy could damn near amount to one-stop shopping. Get your drink, get your bullet, get laid out next door.
"Your office,"
the old bastard cackled as DePape led him down the alley toward the board fence and the heaps of rubbish at the far end. The wind blew, stinging DePape's nose with odors of sulfur and carbolic from the mines. From their right, the sounds of drunken revelry pounded through the side of Hadigan's.
"Your office, that's good."
"Aye, my office."
The old man gazed at him in the light of the moon, which rode the slot of sky above the alley.
"Are you from Magus or T'Apache?"
"Maybe one, maybe t'other, maybe neither."
"Do I know you?"
The old bastard was looking at him even more closely, standing on tiptoe as if hoping for a kiss. Ugh. DePape pushed him away.
"Not so close, Dad."
Yet he felt marginally encouraged. He and Jonas and Reynolds had been here before, and if the old man remembered his face, likely he wasn't talking through his hat about fellows he'd seen much more recently.
"Tell me about the 3 young lords, old Dad," DePape
rapped on the wall of Hadigan's.
"Them and there may not be interested, but I am."
The old bastard looked at him with a bleary, calculating eye.
"Might there be a bit of metal in it for me?"
"Yar," the Pape said. "If you tell me what I want to hear, I'll give you metal."
"Gold?"
"Tell me, and we'll see."
"No, sir. Dicker first, tail second."
De Pape seized him by the arm, whirled him around, and yanked a wrist which felt like a bundle of sticks up to the old bastard's scrawny shoulder blades.
"Fuck with me, Dan, and we'll start by breaking your arm."
"Let go!"
the old bastard screamed breathlessly.
"Let go! I'll trust to your generosity, young sir, for you have a generous face. Yes, yes indeed."
De Pape let him go. The old bastard eyed him warily, rubbing his shoulder. In the moonlight, the blood drying on his cheeks looked black.
"Three of them there were," he said. "Fine-born lads."
"Lads or lords? Which is it, Dad?"
The old bastard had taken the question thoughtfully. The whack on the head, the night air, and having his arm twisted seemed to have sobered him up, at least temporarily.
"Both, I do believe," he said at last. "One was a lord for sure, whether them in there believe it or not, for I saw his father, and his father bore the guns. Not such poor things as you wear, begging your pardon. I know they're the best to be had these days, but real guns, such as were seen when my own dad was a boy. The big ones with the sandalwood grips."
De Pape had stared at the old man, feeling a rise of excitement and a species of reluctant awe as well. They acted like gunslingers, Jonas had said. When Reynolds protested they were too young, Jonas had said they might be apprentices, and now it seemed the boss had likely been right.
"Sandalwood grips?" he had asked. "Sandalwood grips, old Dad?"
"Yep."
The old man saw his excitement and his belief. He expanded visibly.
"A gunslinger, you mean? This one young fellow's father carried the big irons."
"Yep, a gunslinger. One of the last lords. Their line is passing now, but my dad knew him well enough. Stephen the Shane of Gilead, Stephen son of Henry."
"And this one you saw not long ago?"
"His son, Henry the Tall's grandson. The others looked well born, as if they might also come from the line of lords, but the one I saw come down all the way from Arthur Eld, by one line or another, sure as you walk on two legs. Have I earned my medal yet?"
De Pape thought to say yes, then realized he didn't know which of the three culls this old bastard was talking about.
"Three young men," he mused. "Three highborns, and did they have guns?"
"Not out where the drift diggers of this town could see 'em," the old bastard said, and laughed nastily. "But they had 'em all right, probably hidden their bedrolls. I'd set my watch and warrant on it."
"Aye," the Pape said, "I suppose you would. Three young men, one the son of a lord, of a gunslinger, you think. Stephen of Gilead."
And the name was familiar to him. Aye, it was.
"Stephen de Shane of Gilead, that's it."
"And what name did he give this young lord?"
The old bastard had screwed his face up alarmingly in an effort to remember.
"Deerfield? Deer... Stein? I don't quite remember."
"That's all right. I know it. And you've earned your medal."
"Have I?"
The old bastard had edged close again, his breath gagging sweet with the weed.
"Gold or silver? Which is it, my friend?"
"Lead,"
De Pape replied, then hauled leather and shot the old man twice in the chest, doing him a favor, really. Now he rode back toward Mages. It would be a faster trip without having to stop in every dipshit little town and ask questions. There was a flurry of wings close above his head. A pigeon, dark gray it was, with a white ring around its neck, fluttered down on a rock just ahead of him, as if to rest. An interesting-looking bird. Not, De Pape thought, a wild pigeon. Someone's escaped pet? He couldn't imagine anyone in this desolate quarter of the world keeping anything but a half-wild dog to bite the squash off any would-be robber, although what these folks might have worth robbing was another question he couldn't answer. But he supposed anything was possible. In any case, roast pigeon would go down a treat when he stopped for the night. De Pape drew his gun, but before he could cock the hammer, the pigeon was off and flying east. De Pape took a shot after it anyway. Sometimes you got lucky. But apparently not this time. The pigeon dipped a little, then straightened out and disappeared in the direction DePape himself was going. He sat astride his horse for a moment, not much put out of countenance. He thought Jonas was going to be very pleased with what he had found out. After a bit, he booted his horse in the sides and began to canter east along the Barony Sea Road, back toward Magus, where the boys who had embarrassed him were waiting to be dealt with. Lords they might be, sons of gunslingers they might be, but in these latter days even such as those could die. As the old bastard himself would undoubtedly have pointed out, the world had moved on. Two. On a late afternoon, 3 days after Roy DePape left Ritzy and headed his horse toward Hambry again, Roland, Cuthbert, and Alain rode north and west of town, first down the long swell of the drop, then into the freeland Hambry folk called the Badgrass, then into deserty wastelands. Ahead of them, and clearly visible once they were back in the open, were crumbled and eroded bluffs. In the center of these was a dark, almost vaginal cleft, its edges so splintered it looked as if it had been whacked into reality by an ill-tempered god wielding a hatchet. The distance between the end of the drop and the bluffs was perhaps 6 miles. 3/4 of the way across, they passed the flatland's only real geographic feature, a jutting upthrust of rock that looked like a finger bent at the first knuckle. Below it was a small boomerang-shaped greensward, and when